My name is Emily. Most of you all know me. I'm going to be talking a little bit today about a project that I worked on at the end of my time at JVC. It's a little bit connected to my thesis that I wrote, and a little bit different of a new project that I'm working on, looking at hopefully doing a PhD and maybe using this as like a springboard to look into further research. And so the topic is looking at narrative geography and how geography really functions in narrative to give even more details about a text. So for example, well, we all know when we read narrative, it's not filled with details. So I'm suggesting that one of the tools used by the author is geography. So geographical references aren't necessarily just to tell you about place, but they're also to hint and to nudge at something. So for example, looking at what time does the author include certain references. So if someone makes a journey all the way from, take Abraham for example, all the way from Ur of the Chaldeans to Shechem, there are a whole bunch of places that the author could have mentioned where the character stopped at. But why does the author only mention those two specific locations? There's something significant going on with the details of geography that are included. So for this particular study, I focused on Elijah, the prophet Elijah, and then also looking at how the geography in Elijah's story links him to the character of Moses. And so sort of looking back to the Old Testament, and at the same time also looking forward to the New Testament, how the geography in the Gospels, the authors of the Gospels, use geography to sort of link Jesus with Elijah and also with Moses, but to show Jesus as someone even greater than Elijah and Moses. So that's really what the project was. So for us today, I just want us to look a little bit at the background of what's going on in those stories to try to get some, pull some enriching details out of the stories. So if you have your Bible, anybody bring your Bible so you could. We'll maybe start with just Deuteronomy 18 and just read a little bit about what Moses says about a future prophet that will come. So if you want to turn to Deuteronomy 18. Does anyone want to volunteer to read?
What verse?
You could start in 14, 15, and... Yeah, maybe just 14 and 15.
Okay. The nations you will dispossess listen to those who practice sorcery or divination. But as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers. You must listen to him.
Thanks. That's good. So here we read in Deuteronomy that the Lord will raise up a prophet like Moses. Immediately, I mean, one question that comes to mind is, in what sense will the prophet be like Moses? And in what sense will he be different? Like how much like Moses is this prophet going to be? And so for me, when I started looking at Kings and the Elijah stories, it was really interesting to see that there are some major significant points when Elijah is very much like Moses, but at the same time there are some points when he's very much different from Moses. So that would be, I mean, just another area for future study to really examine more of what does this mean, a prophet like Moses? And in what way is Jesus also in this same category? So maybe now we could transition and look at talking about Elijah a little bit. And one of the classes I taught at Trinity this past year was just an introduction to the prophets. And one way of thinking about the prophets that I always stressed to my students was to think of the prophets as covenant mediators. People that stand between God, or a person that stands between the people of Israel and God to mediate the covenant. So that's really Elijah's role. And when you're looking at a prophet, it's always important to ask yourself the question of what situation among the people of Israel and Judah is going on that calls for prophetic covenant mediation. Okay, so you can study the prophet, but even more important when you begin to study is to know the backstory of it. What's really going on among the people that calls for some type of prophet to call them back to the covenant. Okay, so when we think about Ahab and Omri, this is in the 9th century, the northern kingdom of Israel. So I want to just do a little bit of the historical background on what's going on with Omri and Ahab during this time period. So for that, drew the lovely map on the board, which is not a stick person, is a map of Israel. So I want to talk a little bit about Omri, first of all, So if we think in terms of the history of the Northern Kingdom, right? I
mean, Solomon, David, and then, or, well, the other way around. David and Solomon, right? And from Solomon, we get the split of Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And from Rehoboam, so now we're just going to be talking about the northern, the line of the northern kingdom. For now, I really want to leave the southern kingdom alone. But, so from Jeroboam to Omri, we have this period of about 50 years or so, from maybe, we'll just say the 930s to like the 880s, give or take a decade, whatever that kind of. And so in this period, we have a major instability in the northern kingdom. Okay, if you remember the name of Shishak, he's the Egyptian pharaoh that comes up during Jeroboam's reign and really just wipes out the northern kingdom. Okay, he does some damage going to Jerusalem as well. He does major damage in the northern kingdom. Okay, and then from then on, we have a number of insignificant rulers that don't really, aren't able to really make the northern kingdom a powerhouse like it was in the days of Solomon. Until Omri. Omri does some significant things during the 9th century to really make the northern kingdom strong like it had been under David and Solomon. Okay, so a couple of things that Omri does. First of all, he makes two significant treaties. The first treaty is going to be up here with Tyre. Okay, and that will be in the form of his son, Ahab, who will marry Jezebel. Okay, and we'll talk about the significance of that treaty in just a minute. Okay, the second treaty he'll make with Judah. And that will be his daughter, Athaliah, who will marry the son, Jehoram, of the son of Jehoshaphat. Okay, so the king, so now, earlier we had some struggles between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, some fighting back and forth. If you remember Ahab of Asia, there were two kings that fought back and forth. But now we have peace between the north and the south. What do you know? Already that reminds us of the United Kingdom. Maybe they're not best friends, but at least there's a treaty between them. Okay, so two treaties. This one with Tyre, and this one with Judah. Then, another very significant thing that Omri does is he takes, he takes money or foodstuffs from Moab, and we have a king in Moab named Mesha. Mesha, the king of Moab. And you can read this story also in 2 Kings 3. Okay, and also we have Mesha's version of the event in what's called the Moabite Stella, or the Moabite inscription, which is in Jordan today. So we have Omri doing some significant things in terms of two treaties, and he's basically conquered this land. Okay, in terms of rocks, y'all studied a little bit of your physical settings and knowing a little bit about routes. We have two significant trade routes, two that run north and south. The one running in Transjordan, and the other one running along the coast, cutting through and also heading. Okay, both of them are going to head towards Aaron Damascus from the south. So Omri's doing a really significant thing. Okay, his enemy number one at this time for the northern kingdom is going to be Aram Damascus. That's Israel's main enemy. Okay, not thinking about the Assyrians yet that are going to come later and be powerful. But during the 9th century, Aram Damascus is the main enemy of Israel. And so we have Omri wanting to keep Aram Damascus out of his territory because earlier they had been threatening the northern kingdom. So what Omri also wants to do is to keep trade from going up to Aram Damascus and rather to make it head over to Israel, okay, via this city right here, Beit Shan, right, and into his territory. Another significant thing that Omri does, he moves the capital from Tirzah, where it had been, to Samaria, which is closer to the coast. So we have a new capital. It's not so great. Samaria. And now Omri, using his political alliance with Tyre, he's essentially going to try to bend trade to head away from Aram Damascus into his kingdom And then he can take it to the north half of the coast. So he's got some maritime opportunities going on with this relationship. And he's able to really conquer Moab, keep Mesha under his control to sort of bring the food stuffs from Moab into his kingdom and out to the coast. Okay, so that's what Omri has going on for the most part. But the ramifications for Israel are going to be huge, because here sits Ahab in his palace with his wife Jezebel. And really, Ahab, in terms of what we know from extra-biblical inscriptions, he's a powerful king. So the Bible showing Ahab as a weak king is really a reflection on his theological doings, right? His failure to worship God, but his willingness to allow Jezebel to influence his religious practices. So the Bible's really taking a theological stance on Ahab. But we know of two battles that Ahab won against Aram Damascus. The first one here at Samaria, the second one at a city called Aphek. Not the Aphek over here in the coast, but an Aphek just on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. Two battles against Aram Damascus that he wins early on. Okay, but then later then we get Elijah on the scene, and there's some trouble going in the northern kingdom of Israel. Okay, so the main story here is going to be the influence of Jezebel on Ahab. So when we come back to our original question, what's going on in the northern kingdom that calls for prophetic mediation for the covenant, it's going to be the influences of Jezebel, which is brought about in this great scheme of Omri to become wealthy and powerful to create this alliance. So Omri has this trade thing going on, and we know that Ahab continues to rule over Mesha. We know this from the Mesha Stella and also from the Bible, the account in 2 Kings 3. So that's a little bit of sort of the backstory. And now if we step into reading the stories of Elijah, we can really see the people have become confused, right? Ahab and Jezebel have led them into wondering which God do we really follow.
So that's when Elijah really steps onto the scene. Are there any comments or anything? And, I mean, I think you can really make a case for Omri being almost like a David of the North in terms of starting this dynasty. Okay, the dynasty only lasted for Omri and Ahab, and then Ahab had two sons. But the next king who takes over, you remember, is Jehu. And we have an inscription. It's called the Black Obelisk. Maybe if you've seen it in the London Museum. And there's a copy of it in the Chicago Museum, if you ever get there, right? But the Black Obelisk, which is the earliest depiction of a Judean king, right, shows Omri bowing down before Shalmaneser III, the Assyrian king. Jehu, thank you. Shows Jehu bowing down before the Assyrian king Shalmaneser III. And in the inscription it says Jehu of Beit Omri, of the house of Omri. So even though Jehu is not in the line of Omri, okay, so that's only right. He takes over after Jehu, or after Omri's grandson. Not a big deal. But the even more significant thing is that we have an inscription from Tiglath-Pileser III, who's like in the 730s, now we're talking 100 years later, who also has an inscription saying, the northern kingdom, the house of Omri. So in terms of, in the eyes of Assyria, Omri is known as the starter of this dynasty. Omri is really the one who got them on the right track, and based on what he did to make the northern kingdom much more powerful. So that's a little bit what's going on. Now we see Ahab stepping into this great situation. Okay, he's got the wife from Tyre, he's got the alliances, he's got connections with Judah, and he's able to control these trade routes, right? Really significant the way the trade routes are not able to continue to Aram Damascus, but they're all turned in to go to the northern kingdom of Israel. Okay, so that being said, maybe we can look into a little bit of what's going on. If you want to turn to 1 Kings 18, maybe we'll start.
Are those battles in Samaria and Aphek in the Bible?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're going to be
1 Kings 18.
Yeah, maybe actually 17. We'll start at 17. They're in chapter 20, those two battles. So when Elijah comes on the scene, we really have like almost no background. It's like all of a sudden this guy just shows up. And it seems like, you know, sometimes when God calls these covenant mediators or prophets, right, sometimes we know a little bit about where they're from, what they're doing. Elijah, we read that he's a Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead, which part of the study that I did was to look at all the places mentioned in connection to Elijah and figure out if we know where they are, what was there during this time period in terms of archaeology, just sort of looking into the tools of background. And there are some suggestions for Tishbe, but there's not really one that's agreed upon. Some people suggest that Tishbe comes from the verb yashav, like to sit or dwell, and so that maybe Elijah is just mentioned as one of the dwellers or even one of the settlers in this place of Gilead. But what we do know for sure, Tishbe, if it's in Gilead, he's from outside the land, right? Gilead.
Gilead on the other side, from his Jordan.
Okay, so right away, I think if we look at Elijah's life, a lot of his activities take place outside the land. Instantly, it's like Moses, right? Moses, who never got to enter the land. Elijah's also from outside the land. Tishbe, there are a couple of suggestions of cities that might have a toponymic connection, but no one knows for sure. Okay, so Tishbe, he's from outside the land. He's from Gilead. And now he's just going to, all of a sudden, he just shows up with some news. Right, so if somebody wants to maybe volunteer just to read the first four verses of chapter 17 of 1 Kings.
Verse 4.
Yeah.
Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As certainly as the Lord God of Israel lives, whom I serve, there will be no dew or rain in the years ahead unless I be with man." The Lord told him, "Leave here and travel eastward, hide out in the Kirith Valley near the Jordan. Drink from the stream I have already told the ravens to bring you food there."
Thanks. Okay, so this is Elijah's first appearance on the scene. And we read what he says to Ahab. Says there's going to be no dew or rain in the next few years. Does that call into mind anything from Deuteronomy? Yeah, I think it really speaks of the covenant curses and blessings that Moses lays out for us in Deuteronomy. Right? If the people fail to worship God, there will be consequences, and one of the consequences mentioned, okay, there are tons. If you go back and look in Deuteronomy, there's a whole list of consequences, like, you know, famine and plague and death and sickness and being kicked out of the land. But these two are also mentioned, right? No dew or rain. So, I mean, I think that we can easily say, right, there's some connection here to the Mosaic covenant. And then, also, he gets a command to turn eastward and hide in the Kerith Ravine. And feed from the brook. I have ordered the ravens to feed you there. Okay, and then if we keep reading, I'll just read the next two verses as well. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kerith Ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Does anyone have a translation that it says not east of, but says something other than east of in verse 5 there?
Something other than
east.
Kerith Ravine,
and then it says east of the Jordan.
Mine just says the Kerith Valley.
Ah, in verse 5, does it say anything about the Jordan in relation to the Jordan?
Near the Jordan.
Near the Jordan, okay. Anyone, does yours say
same
east of? Okay, that's interesting. Well, because I'll give you one suggestion that was made by Edward Robinson, he's kind of known as like the father of topography, or toponymy. He says that it's going to be this valley right here. Okay, the word in Hebrew, well, Kerith, I'll just write it here. Right, if you take the synonyms, if we look at the letters here, we can see the Kerith in mean, Edward Robinson suggests that it could be the Wadi Kilth, which is going to be going from Jerusalem to Jericho based on the consonants. Okay, R and L is a known in toponymy. It's known that R and L can be switched back and forth. And here we have the T as a carrot. So he says the Wadi Kilth, which maybe you've been there if you've traveled to Jericho from Jerusalem, or if you've stood on the Mount of Olives, you can look down. You can see the Wadi Kilth. So he says, look, is this on the east side, though? What's the problem with this? It's not on the east side. Well, if we actually look to the Hebrew, it doesn't say east. The word for east In terms of direction, it's Kedem, right east.
But actually, the word that's used here is Al-Kmeh, which can be translated a number of different ways. If we were to do a study of all the times that Al-Kmeh appears in the Bible, it's not often translated east, it's sometimes translated near, literally on the face of, right? Upon the face. So it could be anywhere near, okay, either side. Almost like many English translations put an east there. Because it makes sense, right? Elijah's from the east side, right? He's from the Transjordan side, but not necessarily. Okay, Edward Robinson could be right. It could be the Wadi Kilb there, but really we don't know for sure where this place is. So if you want, you can think it's on the east, or you can, maybe it's on the west. So the truth is it's going to be somewhere close to the Jordan. Not necessarily west, even though that's what our English Bibles often translate. Okay, so he's fed by ravens, and if we read verse 6, the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Okay, I like Robinson's suggestion, because in terms of the land of Judah, where does this put him? In the Judean wilderness, right? So he's there in the wilderness, he's in an isolated place. The wilderness, if that is the place, it allows for a better connection to Moses and thinking about Moses journeying with the children of Israel in the wilderness for 40 years. And I think what also helps is this bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. If you remember back to Exodus, the Israelites are fed manna in the morning and quail in the evening. And what's interesting is that the Septuagint, right, the Greek rendering of this story, actually has that Elijah fed bread in the morning and meat in the evening. So it's slightly different wording, right? It doesn't say bread and meat both in the morning and in the evening. It actually says same thing as what the Israelites were fed in the wilderness. So again, we get a strong mosaic picture of Elijah. Like, you know, he's fleeing, okay? He's hiding, sort of like the Israelites fleeing from Egypt. They're in the wilderness. It's a good connection to Moses here with Elijah. Then if we look to the, we'll keep going in the story. And I don't want to read all too much of this for time's sake. Elijah goes to Zarephath, which in looking at this, I didn't really find a connection to Moses at Zarephath, but it's really interesting that in my study, I looked also backwards to Moses and also forwards to Jesus, and I found more of a connection with Jesus, who also travels, okay, outside of the land, and he goes to this area of, okay, Phoenicia or Tyre. So Zarephath is going to be a town. Here in Tyre. Okay, why is it ironic that Elijah would be traveling to Tyre during this time period, during the famine in Israel? Because that's where Jezebel's from, right? So what's going on in Israel at this time, if there's a severe famine, if there's drought, okay, Elijah goes and performs a miracle in Zarephath, the very town where Jezebel comes from, the one who influences, right? So the people there absolutely worship Baal, right? That's their local deity. And Elijah's call is to bring the Israelites back to worshiping the true God. But at the same time, he's not solely focused on Israel. He's also looking outward, looking to the surrounding nations. And it's at the end of this story that we read the woman. If you remember this story, right, you can maybe just, we aren't going to read it all, but if you want to like scan it over, right? He does the miracle. Okay, he goes to a widow, right? He does a miracle, and her food will not run out. And then later, right, her son dies. And she says, all right, Elijah says, oh Lord, why have you brought this tragedy also on this widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? Then he stretches himself out on the boy, and the boy is raised to life. The statement at the end, the woman, this is in verse 24 of chapter 17, then the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is true. Right? She makes the statement about Yahweh that Elijah is longing for the people of Israel to make. Okay, it's a bit ironic because she's the foreigner, right? The famine happens in Israel so that the Israelites will know
who the God is. And Elijah goes outside, right? So his concerns are not only, right, or even we could say God's concerns are not only with the promised people of Israel, but they're always looking out to the Gentiles, right? Israel's calling from the beginning was also to be a light to the Gentiles, to show the peoples of the world who the true God is. So we see Elijah doing that as well. And I think, I don't think we'll even have time to talk about this much this far, so I'm going to just mention it now, that I think Jesus is depicted by the gospel authors as doing similar things to Elijah, especially in the Gospel of Luke. Okay, the author really tries to show Jesus as having a similar mission to Elijah, as being concerned for Gentiles outside the land of Israel as well. So we can see that connection going on here. Okay, then for time's sake, I want to skip ahead to the contest on Mount Carmel. Okay, so let's just, we'll go ahead and turn there. If you would turn to chapter 18. And I think this is a well-known story, so we're not going to read it. We'll just talk a little bit about it. In this narrative, right, we can really see Elijah as a second Moses type figure. Okay, Elijah's really seen as remaking the covenant with Yahweh, just as Moses had done on Mount Sinai. Now they're on Mount Carmel. And it's okay, except this time it's not just the Lord giving the covenant, this time it's a test between Yahweh and Baal. Okay, and afterwards, right, we're all familiar with the story. After Yahweh wins, the prophets of Baal are slaughtered down below near the Kishon spring. It almost seems a little bit parallel, if you remember, after the golden calf incident, when there's this another, it's like a test between Yahweh and another god. And then the Levites, along with Moses and Aaron, slaughter a number of the people, right? 3,000 people that day are killed. It's a little bit parallel with this, after the contest, the slaughtering of people. Only this time it's Elijah slaughtering people down below. So it's, you know, these are gruesome stories, right? We just sometimes skip over it. But yeah, there's definitely a connection there between Moses and Elijah. And really, Elijah, he's depicted by the author of Kings as a prophet like Moses in this covenant mediation ceremony on the mountain. And it seems as if we look, it seems as if Ahab has finally gotten the picture, right? I mean, what would you say is this, like, what would you suspect to be the outcome of this story, right? After the prophets of Baal are slaughtered, the covenant should be renewed, right? The people should all be on board. Look, finally, now we know that God, Yahweh is the true God. But and then if we keep reading, right, the result that we get is the complete opposite. Okay, so maybe we'll just, if someone would be willing to read. Starting in 18, verse 45, and you can read through 19, verse, just maybe verse 4.
Numbers?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, Kings. Sorry.
Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose. A heavy rain came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there, while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I have had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors."
Okay, thanks. So again, we see it's the exact opposite of what we would expect in this story, right? After the Lord wins the contest, Elijah is afraid for his life. Okay, so coming back to what we talked about earlier, the importance of geographical references and narrative, okay, Elijah is now going to make this journey, going from Mount Carmel, right, stopping at Jezreel, and then down all the way down to Beersheba.
And from there, he's going to go further. Right?
So when we look at the story, clearly the author of Kings is intentional about the geographical references that he makes. Because Elijah doesn't make that whole journey without stopping anywhere else. Right? What city does he probably go past that would be really significant that's not mentioned? Yeah, maybe Jerusalem, right? Why is that? I mean, why is he going to Beersheba? So in trying to unpack some of the details of this story, it's interesting to see that there seems like, to me, maybe a link between Beersheba and the patriarchs. Okay, so if you think back to Genesis, what sort of important events are going on at Beersheba? We have Jacob, we have Abraham there. The one that really caught my attention was Abraham and Sarah and also Hagar. So maybe we'll just flip there briefly in Genesis chapter 20. If you remember, let's see. Chapter 21. Right after Isaac is born, I don't want to read the whole story for the sake of time, but you remember the details of the story. There's some bad relations between Hagar and Sarah, right? And it gets to the point where Sarah's the one really in control at this time, telling Abraham, listen, you got to send away Hagar and Ishmael. Okay, and you, if you remember, right, we can read it here too. Abraham was greatly concerned about what's going on, and I'm in verse 12 of chapter 21, 11-12. Do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation also, because he is your offspring. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. She went her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. Okay, so she's doing some wandering. Okay, when the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went off and sat down nearby, about a bowshot away, for she thought, I cannot watch the boy die. As she sat there nearby, she began to sob. God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert. He became an archer. Okay, and we can stop there. Okay, but it seems to me that this story, right, he goes from Mount Carmel to Jezreel. Jezreel, the palace, the location of Ahab and Jezebel's palace, then to Beersheba. Right, he's in the wilderness. There's definitely going to be a wilderness connection with Moses, as we've been talking about already, the connections with Moses. But I think there's also a connection to what happens with Hagar and Ishmael. Okay, maybe the author of Kings had this story in mind, maybe not. But it's similar in the fact that Elijah's there, okay, he wants to die, he ran for his life. Well, in the desert, he went a day's journey into the desert of Beersheba. So we're in the same area as Hagar and Ishmael were. Then if we keep reading, he came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. It feels very similar to the Hagar story of just wanting to die and also sort of wondering, God, have you abandoned me? Like, is this it? Is this the end? And the angel of the Lord comes to Hagar and then there's a well of water provided, and she's reassured that God still has a plan for her life. For Elijah, it's going to be something similar. Okay, he asked that he might die. I have had enough, Lord. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. Then the same thing happens again. A second time, he eats and drinks. The angel said to him, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. Okay, so we can see definitely there's a connection to Moses in the fact that he's going to now travel, doing like a reverse Moses and a reverse Israelite journey, coming out of the land and now going back to the mountain of the Lord. So I think, I mean, for me, it seems like the connection with Beersheba maybe is related to the Hagar story, maybe related to he's going to a city that was important to the ancestors of Israel. Okay, he seems like he's at his wit's end. He's lost all hope, right? After the contest, after the scenes in the northern kingdom, he thinks that he's alone, right? He's had enough. He wants to die. And first God tells him at Beersheba, okay, no, take the food, eat. I have something else for you. And from there, he goes to Horeb. Okay, Horeb is another name for Mount Sinai, right? So now he's going to be going back to the mountain itself where the Lord was given. So in terms of the law was given by the Lord. So in terms of Elijah being a covenant mediator, right, it's like for him, location seems to be important in the story. It's not enough for God to just give him a message in the wilderness of Beersheba. Right, Beersheba, the southernmost city of the border of Judah. We already mentioned that at this time, Judah is in a covenant relationship, a treaty relationship with the northern kingdom of Israel. So if Ahab and Jezebel want to seek out, it's kind of like Snowden, right? Is Russia in a relationship with the States? Can we get this fugitive in our friendly country? Okay, for Elijah, Beersheba is still enemy territory, right? There's a chance that someone will come to Beersheba and get him and bring him back. He doesn't, at this point, he doesn't want to go back to Jezreel, right? So the next place he goes is going to be much further into the wilderness, okay? Not just for the reason of seeking refuge in the wilderness. He's not just wandering somewhere. He's directly going to Horeb, right? Or to Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. Okay, and then we reach that he went into a cave and spent the night. Okay? Suggestions, maybe the cave could be connected to, if there's any memory, right, of the cave of Moses, right? Moses had also gone to Mount Sinai, but not in a cave, but in a kind of a crevice of the rock. And so Elijah is going to have this similar experience on Mount Sinai. But as we read in Deuteronomy 18, the Lord will raise up a prophet like Moses. Okay, Elijah's not exactly like Moses. Elijah's experience of the Lord on Mount Sinai is going to be kind of very different from Moses's. But yet there are some similarities that really call us to believe that Elijah is very similar to Moses. So maybe someone else would want to volunteer to read 1 Kings 19, starting in verse 9. And, yeah, maybe just all the way through verse 14.
And there went to the cave and spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. The Lord was not in the wind. After the wind was there an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came and a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. After the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then the voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Chapter 14? He replied, "I've been very zealous for the Lord Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill you too."
Thanks. Okay, so now we're getting a little bit more of the mindset of Elijah. What's going on in his mind, right? See how he feels so alone. He's the only one left. He's gone to the mountain, and we get what some have called this theophonic triad, right? That we get wind, fire, earthquake, the same elements that were also there in Exodus when the Lord appears to Moses on Mount Sinai. But this time, to Elijah, we read that the Lord was not in the wind. The Lord was not in the earthquake, right? The Lord was not in the fire, but it was through this gentle whisper. Okay, so there's definitely a contrast, because earlier in the story, right, when Elijah's on Mount Carmel, the Lord appears in fire, right? And it's the power defeating Baal. But this time, Elijah's going to learn a different type of message, right? That the Lord appears not just in the power of the fire, not in the traditional symbols, the way that the Lord is able to appear, but also in this quiet voice of a whisper. Something else that's interesting about this passage, okay, if we look at verse 10, right, or even the second part of verse 9, the Lord asked the question, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And as Mike just read, Elijah gives this reply, right? And then the Lord appears. Then Elijah gets the same question again at the second part of verse 13, right? Repeat the second time, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And if we look, his answer doesn't change, right? He gives the exact same answer two times, first in verse 10 and then in verse 14. I mean, what do you make of that, right? If the Lord appears to you, right, and you give an answer, it's not such a good answer, right? He's down on his luck, right? He's at the end of his ropes. He wants to give in, and then the Lord appears. Then the Lord asks again, "What are you doing here?" Do you think, would you expect his answer to change? Or I'm just curious what do you think of this? What do you make of this answer that Elijah gives?
I guess when I've always read it, I always thought of Elijah saying that, and then God asks him again, and then I always picture Elijah kind of meekly answering the same. You know, it's like he was really bold the first time and the second time. It's like, and I just imagine his kind of demeanor changing.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully, there's not a change in words, but hopefully the experience of God being revealed would at least, there's a change in demeanor. Yeah, I think that's very interesting. Hmm.
I think it's like Peter said, Jesus asked him a couple times, "Do you love me?"
Yeah.
You want to go deeper.
Yeah.
So maybe with Elijah, he won't probe.
Yeah, think about it again. Like, is that really your, you know? I think that's really good. Like, God is, you know, God can ask you the same question again. And maybe you give the same answer, but maybe, hopefully, you realize something different the second time. Like, hopefully, you start to begin, okay, if God's asking me again, maybe there's something more to it. You know, maybe I should bring about a change or think deeper about it. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, then immediately following this.
So he wasn't sent there by God. He got up and ate and drank,
yeah,
and gave him the strength to travel.
Okay, that's a good question.
So it doesn't say God sent him to the mountain, because otherwise the answer would be, "What do you mean?
You told me. Yeah." Right. It's. I mean, the way I think about it, I don't know if you can, maybe you have something else to add too, is like, he's at Beersheba. Okay, he's made the journey as far south as he can to flee from Jezebel and Ahab. And from Beersheba, it's like, where are you going to go? He can head to the wilderness. But from there, it's like, well, do I have another place where maybe God would appear? I think he goes there on his own. I think he's just really seeking out the God of the covenant, looking for answers. And so, well, why not go to the place of the covenant? That's kind of my, I don't know. That's kind of what I would maybe do. I'd like to go to Mount Sinai. You guys been to Mount Sinai? Anybody climbed it? You have? Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it doesn't, that's a really good point to bring up, that it doesn't say that God told him to go there. God gives him the food, right? He goes 40 days, which brings up another interesting point in connection to Elijah as a prophet, like Moses, the 4 days and 40 nights without food to get to Horeb, whereas Moses was 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai without food. So there's definitely some parallels that lie in the text. They're strong ones.
And he said you won't be stronger to make the journey.
Yeah, so there's...
So he's suggesting a journey.
Yeah. I mean, what else is said between them? Is there more to it that we didn't hear? Yeah. I don't know. What do you think?
It's just an interesting... It's an interesting thing because the question is so... It always struck me the answer was kind of like... Because I'm thinking God sent it here. So
yeah.
I was thinking, why is it repeated twice? The exact same thing.
Yeah.
So he must have had a lot of feeling about it. Like, this is really bad.
Yeah, I'll tell you again, God. You didn't hear me the first time. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. He's relatable. I'll just throw one. I like this story a lot. I spent time working on it as part of my thesis, and so when I teach at Trinity, I have my students read it, and I got so many papers. They just write a little reflection paper after we talk about it in class about people saying, oh, I really can relate to Elijah. Like, these are students, a lot of them, some of them that have gone to Christian school their life, whole life, some of them that haven't really ever read the Bible before. And now they're saying, oh, I can really relate to Elijah, like when he got to that tree and wanted to die. And then something, and then God came to him, like, oh, you know. I like this story because all through it are these places where Elijah is this great prophet of God. And on the other hand, oh, he's just like us, you know. He's just this human who's struggling to figure out what God wants him to do. Should I go there, God? Are you telling me to go there?
Or when Jezebel said that one and he called out fire or something, you know, because
yeah.
He seemed to have all this.
He's got the power.
Yeah.
The
man will dry up for 3 years, so what's a little...
Yeah, right. This, the power and the weakness and the humility at the same time, like, and closely together throughout the story. Yeah. Yeah. So, skipping ahead, sort of the next thing that happens is Elijah's called to anoint Elisha, right? It's not as if God is sort of done with Elijah, but to say, okay, now you're going to train up someone else. You know, it's time for another prophet. And then the last reference that I wanted to talk about in connection to Elijah being a prophet like Moses is actually the final scene in Elijah's life when he's taken up to heaven. Okay, and there's some interesting, in looking at how geography plays a role in the narrative, there's some interesting geographical connections mentioned. Now we're in 2 Kings chapter 2. And there's some good geographical references if you're going to write about historical geography. This becomes a fun story. Just in the first couple of verses, right, Elijah and Elisha, they're kind of traveling together for a while. And when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Okay, instantly, this brings up a question. Which Gilgal are we talking about? Because there's a Gilgal, which is the place of the first Israelite camp, just north of Jericho, right? And then there's also a Gilgal later in the hill country. So maybe it makes more sense in this story if it's the Gilgal in the hill country. Okay? So they were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." Bethel, which is also in the hill country. So it would be quite a journey. And then the next location that we go to is Jericho. So it would be quite a journey to kind of do like a back and forth. From Gilgal to Bethel, back to Jericho, would maybe be a bit much. So if it's the Gilgal in the hill country, then at least they're kind of like on their way, right? Okay, so these cities are mentioned, Bethel and then Jericho, and it's at Jericho, right? Instantly, we're reminded of the first city that the Israelites conquered, and it's going to be at Jericho, where they cross the Jordan and again head to the other side. We've already mentioned Elijah's really a Transjordan figure, and it's going to be in the Transjordan where he's taken up in the fiery chariot. Okay, but I want to just, we'll end in a couple minutes because I think it's about time to go down to church. But I want to just make a mention of the miracle that happens of them crossing the Jordan River, right? Elijah uses his mantle and they cross on dry ground. Instantly that reminds us of Moses at the Sea of Reeds, right? Crossing with the people. And then it's also going to be Elisha, after Elijah is taken into heaven, he takes the mantle and he himself crosses back on dry ground, crosses the other way, which immediately calls to mind Joshua and the Israelites coming across. So just the fact that Elijah has this Elisha successor makes another link to Moses' successor, Joshua. And the miracles and the fact that they occur, at least the Jericho reference, occurs at the same place where Joshua's miracle occurs. It's like now this is going to be the beginning of Elisha's ministry, just as it was sort of the beginning of Joshua coming into the land to defeat the Canaanites. And if we had a little bit more time, it'd be fun to talk about John the Baptist and Jesus. Also, this same location we read in the Gospel of John that John was baptizing at Bethany beyond the Jordan, which is just north of the Dead Sea. This same region of the country where Jesus begins his ministry after his baptism, coming out of the Jordan River. So that place is very, I think, symbolic in creating this picture of Moses and Joshua and Elijah as a prophet like Moses, and then Jesus also beginning his ministry at the same place. So definitely some geographical connections. And I don't think it just is coincidence. I think it's intentionality of the author to help create the picture, right, using details of geography that give us a deeper understanding of the text. So that would be something to look into further.
And in the meantime, all these places, there were many other settlements, or these were the largest cities, or, because you know when you read it, you think, well, there were probably 10 cities, and so that's why it's here, rather than there are many communities and cities, and as you say, it's mentioning just these.
Yeah.
The Bible mentions just these.
Yeah, I think that there could be other possibilities. So at least
there were other settlements, mm-hmm. just as large.
Yeah, why? I think so. And maybe sometimes it is just, this is the large one, this is where he went. Right, when you're thinking about geography, you have to recognize that the author only has the exact places the person went. So it's like when you're telling a story, right, what are you going to give special attention to? But within geography, they can play around a bit in terms of what they include. But you only have the exact places he went. Right, so what happened where, and what do you include, and why, are sort of things that we can think about. Yeah. So there's like a fixed limit, but within that limit, there are things emphasized. What is the author emphasizing and why?
And he's choosing ones also. I mean, the prophet is choosing those locations also.
Yeah. Right. For sure. Yeah. Cool. Well, that's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.